Let's get started. So we are evaluating the connection to specific heat from quadratic, or as they're also called, Gaussian fluctuations around mean field. And so we found that this connection is given by the following expression. So I have 2d squared A divided by R to the fourth, where R is the effective range of the interaction. And then I have integral from minus pi to pi over this dimensionless wave vector, which I've introduced, dd capital Q, 2 pi to the d, and then 1 over q squared plus a divided by xi squared, where xi is the mean field correlation length, and everything squared, okay? So let me first evaluate this this correction exactly at the critical point, so exactly at the critical temperature, okay? So let me first set T equals TC, right? So at T equals TC, correlation length is infinite. Psi is infinite, and so this term drops out, right? So in this case, I have delta CV equals 2d squared A over R to the fourth, integral from minus pi to pi d dq 2 pi to the d, and then 1 divided by q to the fourth, right? Okay, and so I really want to do this in a general dimension, right? Because the result is going to depend on dimensionality. So what is d dq in a dimension d? So since the integrand is spherically symmetric, right, it depends on the only on the magnitude of the wave vector q, I can write this this volume element as just surface area of a sphere in d dimensions times q to d minus 1 times dq, right? So d dq, so I'll call this surface area of a unit sphere in d dimensions S sub d times q d minus 1 dq. So, you know, in three dimensions, this would be 4 pi q squared dq, right? So in general, we don't really need that, but in general, number of dimensions, this surface area of a unit sphere is twice pi to the d over 2 gamma of d over 2, okay? It's just some number of order 1. Okay, so then what do we have? We have delta CV equals 2d squared A divided by R to the fourth. Then I have this SD, and then divided by 2 pi to the d, and then integral from minus pi to pi. Dq, and I have q to d minus 1 divided by q to the fourth, so I have q to d minus 5, right? Well, so since the limit, the integration limits are finite, you know, there is no trouble coming from high or low or high values of Q. The only problem that can arise is for small values of Q, right? And it's clear in particular that, so if D is greater than 4, so if you are, yeah.
The integral should be 2 minus pi and pi. Yeah. And you're transforming to straight coordinates? It remains the same.
Well, yeah, it does matter, I guess. So I should not write minus pi and pi. It's just, so it's from 0 to something finite, anyway. Something that's of order pi, yeah. Yeah, but that's a good point. So it was minus pi to pi in terms of, you know, the individual coordinates here, but once I transform to spherical coordinates, of course, it's going to be, so I guess it's, what is it? It's pi times root d, right? Something like that. Right. So the point is that, so if d is greater than 4, right, then clearly this integral just converges, right? So the integral and the result is some again, just some number of order 1, right? While if d is less than 4, the integral always diverges at the lower limit at near q equals 0. Right? Okay. So this means that in dimensions greater than 4, mean field theory result for the specific heat is basically correct, right? So we've obtained that in mean field theory, that specific heat jumps at the critical temperature by some number of order 1, and the result still stays, right? So it's no longer 3/2, but it's still some number of order 1. So qualitatively, everything is fine, right? So this means that mean field theory is okay here, and you know the same is true for it can be shown for all the other critical exponents. They don't change, okay? So this here means that alpha is still 0, but it can be shown that all the other critical exponents hold in the same way. But so this result means that in dimensions less than 4, which are precisely the dimensions we care about, right? Mean field theory is incorrect because the correction due to fluctuations just diverges. Okay? So mean field theory is qualitatively wrong. Right. Mean field theory itself does not, but the fluctuations do.
So what does basically mean that the fluctuations depend on the dimensionality of your space?
Well, I mean, physically it means that, you know, the smaller the dimensionality, the stronger the fluctuations are going to be. I mean, one way to understand this is that, you know, the higher the dimensionality, so if you think about the Ising model, the higher the dimensionality, the more strongly, you know, any given spin will be connected to its neighbors, right? Because the number of nearest neighbors increases with dimensionality. So then, you know, if it interacts more strongly with its neighbors, you know, you can expect that fluctuations will be smaller. However, if the number of neighbors decreases, eventually fluctuations become strong. That's kind of a simple explanation. Okay, so in dimensions we care about, mean field theory is qualitatively wrong. So this dimensionality d equals 4. This is called the upper critical dimension. And so the meaning is that it separates dimensions for which mean field theory works from dimensions for which mean field theory doesn't work. Yeah.
So here we consider the second order change in action, right? To equal fluctuations.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So how do we know that the higher order terms will not change delta CV? It might make it.
Yeah, I mean. They do, exactly. So that's the point, that we cannot just, you know, this fact that mean field theory fails just means that we cannot evaluate that integral for the partition function by the settle point method, right? That's what it means formally. It's the settle point method for the evaluation of the integral that fails here. That's what this infinity, this divergence means. Of course, I mean, if we evaluated that integral exactly, there would be no problems. Right? Well, although, I mean, CV would still diverge. CV does diverge at the critical point. Now let me actually find how exactly that. Correction to the mean field result for the specific heat diverges at the critical point. Okay, and so that's going to give me my kind of first non-mean field approximation to this critical exponent alpha. Okay. So for this I have to go back to this expression where now psi is finite. And let me rewrite that expression in the following way. So I have delta CV so equals 2t squared a over r to the fourth. Right, and then I have integral from minus pi to pi d dq to pi to the d. And let me do the following. Let me pull out this ratio outside. So I'll have I'll have psi divided by a to the fourth, right? And then integral from minus pi to pi d dq to pi to the d, and then 1 over 1 plus, q times psi divided by a, everything squared, and then squared, okay? And let me now change variables again. in this integral. So let me call now this my integration variable. So I have a new dimensionless wave vector k, which is equal to q psi divided by a. Right? So then this integral has the following form. It's 2d squared a divided by r to the fourth. Well, I can actually cancel a here. So I get so psi divided by r to the fourth now. So then I will have a divided by psi to the d, right, from the change of the integration measure. Yeah.
About
CV
divergent.
Uh-huh.
I guess I'm having a little bit of trouble understanding what that would
mean
physically,
in terms of specific heat divergent. Well, so specific heat is what? So specific heat is, dq dt at constant V. So divergent specific heat means that so what does it mean?
It seems like it's saying that you would need an infinite amount of heat to raise it by a degree, say, at the critical temperature. So that would seem to suggest you can never, like, cross the critical temperature if you're coming at it from either above or below.
That's why we feel very intense.
Specific heat, of course, specific heat always diverges at TC. This is not an physical result, right? So specific heat means large specific heat means that you need a lot of heat, right, to raise the temperature by of the system by a little bit. I guess so. Large specific heat means that there are a lot of modes in the system that can absorb the heat. Right, and so that's precisely what happens at the critical point, that you get a lot of fluctuations on all length scales that can absorb the heat.
If it's really infinite, then wouldn't that somehow suggest that if you're trying to cool something like this down, as you approach the critical temperature, you need heat to cool below it or heating it?
Right. So what would it mean? Well, so that's also a good point. So the total heat you need to transfer is, of course, the integral of CV over temperature, and the fact that it diverges at the critical temperature does not mean that that's a good point. That doesn't have to be, yeah. An integral can still be finite, of course. Yeah, that's a good point. Okay. So let's continue with the evaluation of this integral. So I get if q goes between minus pi and pi, then that's k goes between minus pi psi divided by a to pi psi divided by a, right? And I have dk 2 pi to the d 1 over 1 plus k squared, right? And now, so since,
Sorry, just a quick question. Is that a Q or an A? But Q over C or A over C?
No, this is A.
Okay.
Of course, yeah. Yes, sorry. Yeah, my Qs and As are similar. This is the reason I wanted to change the variables now. Since psi is diverging at the critical point, I can just change now the integration limits here to minus and plus infinity. Okay. So I have minus infinity to infinity, right? And you know, so this integral clearly converges, right? And this is just a simple number, which I don't even care about. Okay, I can calculate it, but I don't need to. Right? So what this shows is that you know, so this is an example of what I said before, that it's always useful to convert. If you have to do an integral, it's always useful to convert it to dimensionless variables, because then sometimes you don't actually need to evaluate it. And that's the example of that. Right? I've converted this to these new variables. And now, since I can replace the integration limits by minus or plus infinity, the integral is just a simple number, which I don't care about. And so what you see is that the delta CV scales as psi to 4 minus d. Okay, so that's the important thing. And now psi, we know, correlation length goes as T, reduced temperature to minus 1/2, right? So therefore, delta CV then goes as T to D over 2 minus 2. Okay, so this is our result for alpha then. Alpha is 2 minus D over 2. Okay. And so this, of course, we are assuming here that d is less than 4 now, okay, where delta CV is actually diverging. So this, you know, this is the first example of dependence on dimensionality, at least appearing in the critical exponent, right? So this critical exponent alpha actually cares about the dimensionality of space, and the divergence gets stronger as dimensionality is reduced. Okay, but of course, you know, this result is also wrong because to obtain this, we've basically assumed we've expanded around mean field theory. We've expanded in fluctuations around mean field theory, this calculation in fact shows that we cannot do it. Okay, so,
this calculation, basically, you assume T different from TC, but you didn't make any assumption whatsoever about the dimensionality, right? What I'm worried about is that you put there the D smaller than 4, because
right,
we know that qualitatively and mean field theory, it's
well,
okay.
Well, yeah, if you put D smaller than 4, then this thing simply vanishes at when T is going to 0, right?
Right.
I mean, that's just saying that basically delta CV is some constant.
So, I mean, if D is greater than 4, I can also define my alpha as critical exponent.
There is no divergence, right? So then I can simply take T to 0.
Okay, so you take
and yeah, there's nothing, there's no problem, right? It's not, there is no divergence, basically, in that case. Yeah.
Another thing, so we did this only in the Ising model.
Right.
What makes us think that the other systems will have the same critical exponents like this?
The purpose of this functional integral formalism is to, in fact, generalize. And that's what we will start doing right now. And so, as we'll see, what matters is some very general properties of the system, like symmetry, like nature of the order parameter, and details are not important.
So if I have, for example, our Hamiltonian was quadratic in the sigmas, right? So
right.
If I take any other Hamiltonian that has a quadratic term like this, then I should expect that some critical exponents like this appear.
Yeah, so you know, so if you take anything that has an order parameter which is scalar, right, and which has the same symmetry, meaning that you know it's the Hamiltonian is invariant under the change of sign, then you should expect the same critical exponents as for the Ising model. So for example, the liquid gas transition at the critical endpoint where the transition is actually second order has the Ising 3D Ising critical exponents, and that's because you can define an order parameter there which is the difference between the density of the liquid and the gas, so it's a scalar. So you would not think that you know gas to liquid transition has anything to do with the Ising model. But that's the point, that it only cares about very general things. It doesn't care about any microscopic details. So what I want to do now is, in fact, to start showing how, you know, so far what all we've been doing is studying Ising model, right? What I want to do now is show how, as far as the properties of the system near a continuous transitions are concerned, we can in fact, you know, generalize this simplify this theory, and the details that will remain in the theory will in fact be, only related to very general properties of the Ising model, like the nature of the order parameter and the symmetry, and all the other details will just disappear. Okay?
We calculated this sort of quantities from the Helmholtz potential, right?
Helmholtz free energy, right?
We showed that in this particular case, it is dependent on the correlation function, right? So almost every quantity that I can derive from the free energy is dependent on the correlation function. So that implies that the critical exponent associated to the correlation length is not independent of the other.
No, it's not. Yeah. So no. In fact, as I said before, you only need to know a couple of critical exponents, and you can find the rest of them from what's called scaling relations. So I have not actually talked about scaling relations in the mean field context, but we will talk about them later. But you know, basically, all you need to know is how free energy depends on correlation length, order parameter, and the external field that couples to the order parameter. And from that, so you know, that can be specified by basically a couple of critical exponents. And from that, from that scaling ansatz for the free energy, all the other critical exponents can be obtained, you know, because all these quantities are basically derivatives of the free energy with respect to something. So you know, this can be seen pretty easily from the from mean field theory. You know, you can just look at the mean field expression for the free energy and see how it scales with the correlation lengths and order parameter and the field. But then, you know, basically the scaling ansatz is that the same type of scaling relation holds except with general values of those critical exponents, not the mean field ones.
So here's the fundamental thing to characterize your phase transition, that's your order parameter and your correlation function. However, the correlation function can be always calculated in terms of your order parameter, as we did in this case.
So sorry. So what do you mean? The correlation function is a correlation of fluctuations of the right. order parameter at different points.
All right.
That answered
my question.
Yeah. Okay. Let me just so before we start. Get to something else. Let me just mention one more thing. Okay, so we've shown that that near the critical point, mean field theory always breaks down. Okay, but the question is, is mean field theory good for anything at all? And the answer is yes, as long as you're not too close to the critical point. And so let me just derive a criterion for when mean field theories can be trusted, okay? Which is called Ginzburg criterion. So I guess this was first derived by Ginzburg in the context of Landau-Ginzburg theory of superconductivity. So basically, I can just take this diverging correction to the specific heat, which goes as T to minus alpha. But let me also include the dependence on this range of the interaction R. Okay, let me write this as delta CV goes as A divided by R to the fourth, and I have A here just to make this ratio dimensionless, right? And then I have T to minus alpha, right? So basically, the criterion then for when mean field theory is okay would be that this correction is much less than one, right? Which is this jump of the specific heat at the transition, which is the mean field result, right? So as long as we are far enough from small t equals zero, which corresponds to the critical point, far enough so that this delta CV is much less than the mean field result, the jump, which is of order one, then mean field theory can be trusted. Mean field theory is okay. So I have then A divided by R to the fourth, T to minus alpha is much less than one, right? Or I can write this as, so if I plug in that that result for alpha, so I have T to D over two minus two is much less than R over A to the fourth, okay? So this is the Ginzburg criterion. And so what this is saying is that the mean field theory, when D is less than four, always breaks down as long as you get close enough to the critical temperature, yeah. That the jump of the specific heat at the transition is of order one, right, or three halves.
So you want the correction to be less than the jump at the transition, even though you're not thinking about the transition anymore, you're far from the transition.
Well, I'm still somewhere not too far from the transition, but yeah.
You're not,
I want the correction to be negligible compared to...
So you want to be far from the transition, but not too far from the transition.
Yeah, well... Yeah. Well, so the again, the idea is the following. So let's say if I have CV as a function of T, and here I have my TC. So in mean field theory, the result is like this, right? You get something below TC, and then it jumps to zero, let's say. Right, at TC. So now in reality, what happens is that it may look like this, sufficiently far away from the transition. But as I get close, this jump actually becomes a divergence. Okay? And what I'm saying here that as long as I'm far enough, right, that divergence can be neglected. Right? That's what this means.
It's not clear to me why it's the transition, the value of the transition at TC, which is what you want to compare to.
Well, I mean, what else can I compare with, right? So the question is whether CV versus T looks like CV versus T that's obtained by mean field theory or not, right? Then that's the point. And the answer is yes, it does, as long as you are not too close. Because if you get too close, then actually divergence starts to set in. What kind of the important thing that this shows is that so how close you can get to the transition before mean field theory starts to break down depends on this range of the interaction parameter, right? So this says that the longer the interactions are, in general, the closer you can get to the transition before the mean field theory starts to break down, right? And I guess as you have seen in your tutorials, if you actually make the range of the interaction infinite, then mean field theory is always exact. Okay? This is in fact the reason for why, as I mentioned before, you know, there is one transition and that's observed experimentally that's extremely well described by mean field theory, and that's the superconducting normal transition in normal metals. And so in that case, kind of if you study the microscopic theory of superconductivity, the BCS theory, then that's the reason, because the interaction between the Cooper pairs is extremely long range, not in real space, but in the momentum space. Okay, so that's the origin of the fact that you basically, you know, to observe that divergence for the superconducting transition, you just have to get to critical temperature to within, you know, well beyond the experimental resolution. Okay, so now let's really kind of try to move away from the Ising model. And so the observation that we should make from this discussion is that so what's important near TC, what's important for these universal properties of continuous transitions that we are after are fluctuations at long length scales, right? And the length scales of the order of the correlation lengths, because, you know, the divergences in these integrals are due to small wave vectors, so due to long wavelength fluctuations, right? So important fluctuations happen on long length scales, which in fact get longer and longer as we approach the transition, closer and closer. And so this suggests that, you know, if I take this the action for the Ising model, so I have the exact action sum over I and j phi I j I j inverse phi j minus sum over I log of twice hyperbolic cosine phi I divided by t you know, this suggests that this action contains a lot of unnecessary information, right? It contains information about the specific form of the interaction between the spins on the length scale of A, right? While what we are interested in is actually what happens at long length scales. And on such long length scales, it should not matter, you know, what happens on length scales, I don't know, 1,000 or 1,000,000 times smaller than the correlation length, right? So let's try to write down the long wavelength form of that functional. Yeah.
Saying that is equivalent to, I mean, if A is the lattice spacing, that is equivalent to send A to zero, like sending my natural length of the system to zero.
So this is what I want to say is that all I care about is the modes of phi, which change slowly on the very slowly on the length scale of the lattice, and yeah, so it's equivalent. So in fact, what we will derive is the continuum version of that.
So that justifies using, I mean, from a discrete model going to a field theory to describe.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So what we will do now is precisely that. So we will go from this discrete model to a continuum field theory.
I'm sorry, the justification for considering only fluctuations on the long scale is that the upper bound is set by the longest length, by the correlation?
Well, yes. So it's because, you know, it seems like from these calculations that what determines the critical properties are fluctuations at long length scales, at small wave vectors and correspondingly long length scales. Okay. So you know, basically, in other words, we want to retain only the essential properties of this functional, the properties which are important for describing critical phenomena. While this, you know, contains a lot of unnecessary details, and it, you know, it looks ugly, right? And it's difficult to work with it. Okay, so let's try to simplify this. So first of all, instead of this Jij inverse, this horrible thing, what I will use is my small wave vector expansion for J of Q, right, which is valid precisely at long wavelengths. So I have J of Q, as we discussed, is J minus 1/2 K Q squared. And so J and K are parameters which are related to the microscopic properties of the Ising model, but from now on we won't care what they actually are. These are just some positive numbers, positive parameters. Okay, what we care about is the functional form of that. It's something minus something else times Q squared. Okay, so that's the expression of symmetry. Okay. Another thing, the second term in that function is also very ugly, right? It's log of hyperbolic cosine. But so near the transition, since phi, the average value of phi is small anyway, you know, we should be able to do fine if we just expand this function to a couple of leading terms in powers of phi. Okay. So far this will be just worse, but the rigorous justification for doing that is going to come from renormalization group, which we will get to in the next week. So I'll expand log of twice hyperbolic cosine of pi I divided by t. So this is approximately equal to log 2 plus 1 half pi I divided by t squared, and then minus 1 twelfth pi I divided by t to the fourth. And so we need to expand minimum to phi to the fourth. And I explained why already when I talked about Landau theory, right? So this is, this term is needed for stability. It's needed to ensure that the minimum of this of this functional describes something physically sensible with a finite value of phi. Okay, so then let me first deal actually with the first term. So that's the most complicated thing. Let me call that S0 of phi. So this is the quadratic part. So I have, and let me include also this term into the quadratic part of the functional. So I have 1 over 2 t squared sum over I and j phi I, then I have t here j I j inverse phi j, and then from this term I just get a Kronecker delta, so minus delta I j. Question? Yeah.
Can you repeat why is expansion on phi valid? I mean, where you consider phi to be small?
Well, because so what we are interested in is what happens near the critical temperature, right? So so when T is less than TC, I guess even when T is less than TC, I expect some non-zero average value of phi, but that's small because we are near TC, right? Above TC, average value of phi is zero, right? So again, it should be okay to ignore higher order terms. But these are not rigorous arguments. The rigorous arguments will come from randomization group. So for now, this is just, you know, it's just a matter of convenience because, you know, we can't do much with log of hyperbolic cosine. That's one thing. And then another thing is that, again, the specific form of that function comes from the Ising model. The fact that I have hyperbolic cosine instead of something else, that's a consequence of the fact that I have a degree of freedom which can take, you know, values 1 and minus 1. If I had, let's say, also a scalar degree of freedom, but which could take more values, let's say 2, 1, 0, minus 1, minus 2, that function would change.
Perfect. So the action is in general for the pilot pipe, right? For the pipe.
Yeah.
Are we considering the action near the mean field approximation? Or
near the mean field critical point. Yeah. So, you know, of course, we cannot solve this problem exactly anyway. So, right, as you will see, what we will be doing is expansion near four dimensions. So I will assume that the space dimensionality can be taken to be a continuous variable, and we'll do an expansion in small deviations from d equals 4, where mean field theory works. Okay, so then the critical exponents we'll find, you know, will be mean field ones plus some terms which are small, which are proportional basically to powers of the deviation of dimensionality from 4. So what people do is you can actually get very precise results by this. If you calculate enough terms in that power series, you can actually, you know, extrapolate with good precision to, let's say, three dimensions and get pretty good results. But what we'll do, of course, is just leading order. Okay. Okay, so I have phi I t j I j minus 1 minus delta I j phi j. So again, this contains that term and this quadratic term that comes from the expansion of log of hyperbolic cosine. So let me now rewrite this thing in Fourier representation in the wave vector space. Okay, and here I want to apologize. So I slightly screwed up when I introduced Fourier transform, but just slightly. So I've defined the Fourier transform of phi with a 1 over root n before. I mean, we didn't actually use it anywhere, but that's what I said. But it's actually more convenient to define it with 1 over n, just as Fourier transforms of other things. Okay, it's just for convenience, and you will see why. So I have phi I 1 over n sum over q phi of q e to I q dot ri, and then also j I j is 1 over n sum over q j of q I q dot ri. And so okay, so let me actually do this transformation explicitly on this term. Maybe I'll stop doing that later, but I'll do it explicitly now. So let's take this and plug this in here. So I have S0 of phi equals 1 over 2 t squared. So sum over I and j. So I have 1 over n sum over, let's say, q. Well, let's say q phi of q e to I q dot ri. Put t in here. Then I have so 1 over n again, sum over q prime j inverse of q prime, and then e to I q prime dot ri minus rj, right? Let me actually do this only for this first term, right? Explicitly, because this is going to be simpler. So this is just the first term, and then another 1 over n sum over q double prime phi of q double prime e to I q double prime dot rj, right? So now what happens? So now we again use that 1 over n sum over I, let's say, gives me a Kronecker delta of the corresponding momenta or corresponding wave vectors. So I'll often call wave vectors momenta. So don't be confused by that. That's the same thing. So think of h bar being equal to 1. So wave vectors are the same as momenta. So I have 1 over n sum over I e to I, so I get q plus q prime plus q plus q prime is equal to delta q and q prime, right? That's one Kronecker delta, and then 1 over n sum over j e to minus I q prime minus q double prime dot rj, that's equal to delta q prime and q double prime, right? No, so this is q plus q prime, and it's also q. Yeah. So delta q, thank you, and minus q prime. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Ri. So this means that that q double prime is equal to minus q, right? So then what I get from this is 1 over 2 t squared, 1 over 2 t, just 1 over n, sum over q, phi of minus q, J inverse of Q, phi of Q, right? And for the second term, it's going to be the same thing, but just one instead of J minus one of Q, right? Okay, so then I get so my S0 of phi now has the following form. It's 1 over 2 t squared n sum over q phi of minus q. So t. And so J inverse of Q is just 1 over J of Q, right? Since J, matrix J, is diagonalized in Fourier space, right? So this is T divided by J of Q minus 1 phi of Q, right? So now I can use the small wave vector form for J of Q, and I will expand to leading order in Q squared, right? So let me just write down the answer, I guess. Let me first do the following. Let me rewrite this J of Q in the following way. Let me pull out J in front, and then I have 1 minus so K divided by 2J Q squared, and you remember that this ratio K over J has a meaning of the range of the interaction squared, right? So this I can write as just J 1 minus 1 over 2D, because there was a D in the definition of our range of the interaction squared, times R squared times Q squared, okay? And so that's precisely our small parameter of the expansion, right? We are assuming that we are interested in fluctuations at distances, large compared to the range of the interactions. So then this thing in the square brackets I can write in the following way. If I expand to to leading order in Q squared, so this is approximately equal to T, right, this reduced temperature, and that comes from the fact that this J is the main field critical temperature, right? So I write this as TC. So this is T plus this thing, plus 1 over 2D R squared times Q squared. Mm-hmm.
One question with respect to that last step. So we're interested in long range, I mean long length scales.
Mm-hmm.
But does imply as well that Q is small.
Right.
Right. So the product of R and Q is not order one.
No. So we are interested in So what does large distances mean? Precisely distances larger than the range of the interactions. Right. So that's kind of is.
So Q
which is smaller than 1 over R, that precisely means distances which are larger than R, right? Okay, so then I get S0 of phi. So this is 1. And then, so this T here, right, since I'm interested in what happens close to TC, I'm going to replace this by TC, okay, to make the coefficient constant. So the T dependence that we care about is the T dependence in here, right? Because this thing is what this thing vanishes at TC. So that's important. While the T dependence here, then that's not important near TC. Okay, so I have 1 over 2 TC squared times N. Sum over Q, phi of minus Q. So T plus 1 over 2D R squared Q squared, phi of Q, right? And let me do one other step. So it's convenient always to keep the just to reduce the number of parameters that define our functional to fix the coefficient of one of the terms to be equal to 1, right? And that I can always do by just redefining my variables. Okay, so let me redefine phi's in the following way. Redefine phi of Q. So I'll define new phi's, phi tilde of Q, just to precisely to remove that coefficient here and make it equal to 1/2, in fact. Okay. So I'll define phi of Q to be equal to R. So I want A here. So what I want to do is, and this will be important for, transforming later to a continuum limit where I just integrate over space. I want this coefficient here to be the volume, 1 over volume, because 1 over V sum over Q can be transformed into an integral over Q, right? So I want actually a factor of a to the d in the denominator here. So that's why I have a in this redefinition of the variables. So r a to d over 2 root of 2d times tc times phi of q. And so if I rewrite as 0 phi in terms of phi tildes, and I will drop tildes, of course, immediately, then I get the following thing. So I get a 0 of phi. This is equal to 1 over 2n a to the d, a to the d, sum over q, phi of minus q, r, I will say what r is in a second, plus q squared, phi of q, and r is simply, so I call this coefficient proportional to t. I called it R because this is the a common notation. So R explicitly is equal to 2dt divided by R squared. Okay, this coefficient is not important. What's important is that R is directly proportional to t. So R changes sign at tc. Okay, so R is proportional to t. Okay. Okay, and so now I can finally transform this to an integral over Q. Okay. This is done by the usual prescription that 1 over V sum over Q, right, we transform into integral d dQ to pi to the d, right? And so then I get finally the following result, that is 0 of phi is equal to 1/2 integral d dQ to pi to the d, right? Phi of minus q, r plus q squared phi of q. Okay. And now I can transform this this back to real space. Okay. And so here I will use the Fourier transform in continuum. So let me call the real space coordinates. I will call them x with a vector. So I'll have phi of x now, right? So the memory of the lattice is gone now, right? So I have phi as a continuous as a field. Phi of x equals integral d dq to pi to the d, phi of q e to I q dot x, right? And so this q squared in Fourier space, that's equivalent to gradient squared in real space, right? Because when I take the gradient, right, of phi of x, that pulls down 1 power of q, right? So 2 powers of q corresponds to gradient of phi squared. So then in real space, this becomes as 0 of phi equals 1/2 integral d dx. So grad phi squared plus r phi squared. Okay. And so these, you know, these terms have very simple physical meaning. So if you remember, so I told you that so this q squared comes from the expansion of j of q, right, at small q, and the meaning of that term there was the reduction of the interaction energy between the spins if the spins are not exactly aligned, right? So this precisely is what expressed by this gradient of phi squared term, right? This is the energy cost for having the order parameter at different nearby spatial points, not exactly uniform, right? This is the energy cost for non-uniform configurations of the order parameter. Okay? While this, so this is the usual thing that you know, when R is greater than 0, meaning T is greater than TC, this gives me the minimum at phi equals 0, while when R is less than 0, that transforms this minimum into a maximum. Okay? And this also, you know, looks, so if I identify now one of the spatial directions with time, right? So this looks just like the Klein-Gordon theory for free particles, right? Well, except if I change my time to imaginary time. So this is Klein-Gordon theory in imaginary time, okay? So this is connection with field theory. And in fact, you know, a lot of the a lot of things in statistical mechanics have very, very close connection to quantum field theory. But the difference from field theory of free particles is that we also have that phi I to the fourth term, right, which I have not taken into account so far. Well, and so that term is easy to deal with, right? So I have S1 of phi, so it's 1 over 12 t to the fourth, so that's the phi to the fourth term that came from the expansion of log of hyperbolic cosine, sum over I, phi I to the fourth. So this I simply, since I have one filled phi I per a to the d, per volume a to the d in real space, right? I can simply transform 1 over a to the d sum over I, right, to integral d dx. And that coefficient is just something that's positive. That's all we need to know. Okay, so then I can simply add here. Just want to make sure I have right notation. So let me put this 1/2 inside plus r over 2. And then I have plus u over 4. Over 4 is just for convenience, phi to the fourth, okay? So this is just, again, a Klein-Gordon theory, but for interacting particles, for particles with short-range interactions. And so, in fact, this is all we need to know to describe critical properties of something in the Ising universality class, okay? So no other information from this horrible thing is needed, right? All we need to know is we have this R, which is supposed to change sign at the transition, and we have U, which is positive. Yeah.
The interpretation of phi itself is the field due to the spins around the part around.
Yeah. So phi, it's either. It's either spins which are averaged over value of the spin which is averaged over some distance which is larger than the lattice spacing, right, but smaller than the correlation length, or you can think of this as molecular field, whatever, yeah.
Okay, so when R is positive, we want phi to be zero.
Yeah, we want phi on average to be zero.
Yeah.
Okay, so again, the only thing we really need here is that R is proportional to T, and U is greater than zero. Is a constant which is greater than zero. Yeah.
Can you repeat again why we said that phi I over T is small?
Phi I is small. I mean, it's not really. So simple justification is that we are looking at what happens near the phase transition, right? Where average value of phi is small anyway. So it's exactly zero on the right, and it's small to the left of the transition point. But the real justification is that you know, all the other terms that we might add, I mean, I could expand further to phi to the 6, phi to the 8, what we will see is that they will be irrelevant as far as, you know, the as far as the properties of the transition are concerned. So the rigorous justification for this is irrelevant. I could also have higher gradients of phi, right? And those are also irrelevant. So these are these terms, these three terms are the only thing that's relevant as far as the critical properties are concerned. Yeah.
So when you change that sum to an integral, should there be an n in there?
Sorry?
When you change the sum to an integral, is there meant to be an n in there as well?
Well, I screwed up, of course. So it should be a to the d times sum of I, right? So this has dimensions of volume, right? So I have to have. This is the volume. I mean, so you know, the point here is that I have one field phi I per the volume of the unit cell.
Okay. But
right? No. So that is just, you know, that this thing is how you transform the sums over momentum into momentum integrals. This is transforming sum in real space. Into a real space integral, right?
Okay.
But the point is, the idea is precisely the same, right? I do this because 2 pi to the d divided by v, that's exactly the volume per one state in momentum space.
Right.
So it's exactly the same thing,
okay.
In fact. When we do renormalization group, it will be convenient to have this as 4 factorial, right? But when you do, let's say, mean field theory, it's convenient to make it 4. It's just, you know, not to have extra factors of order 1 in front of things. I will change it to 4 factorial. Next time. So, I mean, the reason it's more convenient to have 4 here is because, so let's now do mean field theory with this one, right? So to do mean field theory, I assume that order parameter is constant, that phi is constant. So this term just, gradient term just disappears, right? And then I simply minimize this. So when I minimize it, I get r times phi, right? That's the reason I have 1/2 here, so that it cancels these 2. And then the reason to have 4 is so it cancels the 4. So I have plus u phi cubed, this is equal to 0, right? And so the mean field solution is phi equals plus minus square root of minus r divided by u, okay? And so that precisely gives you the order parameter critical exponent. That's 1/2, right? Because R is proportional to the reduced temperature. Okay. So in fact, it's obtained that easily from this thing, and all the other results that we have discussed so far, which you know we worked pretty hard to obtain. Can actually be obtained just as well from this theory. Okay, yeah.
Remember the minimization of the action here. There's no term with the derivative.
Should
it be like a differential equation for phi?
Right. I mean, no. But I'm just assuming that phi that minimizes the action is uniform. Right. So if my system is translationally invariant, that's a reasonable assumption. In principle, yeah. I mean, if I consider, let's say, a system with a boundary, and I want to see, boundary between 2 different regions, then, and if I want to see what happens at the boundary, then of course, I should not make this assumption, and then I can indeed derive a differential equation for phi. Yeah. And this is in fact so one of the most successful applications of these ideas is Landau and Ginzburg theory of superconductivity. For example, Abrikosov got his Nobel Prize for basically predicting that a superconductor in the presence of magnetic field is going to have a vortex lattice in that. And that's precisely a solution of this type of equation in a non-uniform situation. And when you have magnetic field present, he found that the solution is a vortex lattice and got a Nobel Prize for this eventually. So let me now introduce one very useful thing that we will use a lot later. So what I want to do is define a thing that's called dimension of different things here. So I will define a dimension of any physical quantity to be its dimension in units of inverse length, or dimensions in units of wave vector. Okay. So I'll define then dimension of wave vector, any wave vector, to be 1. Right? So then follows immediately that dimension of any spatial coordinate is -1, right? Because wave vector is 1 over wavelength, -1. And then we can figure out the dimensions of the rest of the quantities here from the fact that S of phi is dimensionless, right? Because so what we have is the partition function equal integral over phi. So now this integral is really a functional integral because phi is a continuous field. E minus S of phi, right? And so clearly, since I have just E to minus S of phi must have dimension 0, right? So then, so if you look at this term then, right, so we can figure out the dimension of phi. So I must have dimension of volume, which is x to the d. So dimension of x to the d, right? Plus, so this gradient squared gives me dimension of x to minus 2, right? Because it's square of the derivative. So plus dimension of x to minus 2 plus dimension of phi squared. So this sum has to be equal to 0, right? Because the whole thing is dimensionless. So therefore, I have this is minus d, right? This is plus 2, right? Plus, and this dimension of phi squared is twice the dimension of phi. This is equal to 0. So therefore, dimension of phi is equal to d minus 2 over 2, right? Right? So Now, from this term, we can then find the dimension of R, right? So I have, again, dimension of x to the d plus dimension of r plus dimension of phi squared has to be equal to 0. So therefore, I have minus d plus dimension of r plus twice dimension of phi, which is 2d minus 2, so plus 2d, just d minus 2 plus d minus 2. So this is equal to 0, so therefore dimension of r is 2, right? And finally, from the last term, I can find the dimension of u. So I get, again, minus d, right, plus 4 dimensions of phi. So this is plus 2d minus 4 plus dimension of u is equal to 0. And so the dimension of u then is equal to 4 minus d, right? So this 4 here, this is in fact the upper critical dimension. Okay. So it's not a coincidence that so above 4 dimensions, dimension of u is negative, while below 4 dimension, dimension of u is positive. So you'll find that basically the quantities whose dimension is negative are precisely the quantities which are irrelevant and which can be ignored, okay? While the quantities whose dimension is positive are relevant, okay? Okay, so let's stop now. And I guess the Monday is a holiday, so we are meeting on Tuesday.